You are listening to a session recorded live at the AAAS annual meeting held February 17th through the 21st, 2011 in Washington, D.C. Now to our session.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. And welcome to the AAAS session on the practice of science diplomacy in the earth sciences. My name is Tom Cassidaval. I'm with the U.S. Geological Survey in Denver, Colorado. I think by virtue of the fact that you're here, you demonstrate an interest in at least the words or the title, science diplomacy. And if you've been following the development of the discussion and the use of the term, you're aware that it's considered a component of soft power, which is in contrast to hard power, guns and bullets contrast. And it's a concept that's been around for several decades, but when the new Secretary of Defense Gates gave sort of an inaugural address at Kansas State in the fall of 2007, he outlined one of his main interests was seeing a better development of soft power in places in the world where the U.S. has diplomatic interests as a balance or a contrast to the hard power. In President Obama's June 2009 presentation in Cairo, he talks more about soft power and specifically, I think, may have used the words science diplomacy in the context of the soft power paradigm. And he, in his Cairo speech, mentions that he's going to identify science envoys, particularly to the Muslim world, as a first movement in the science diplomacy arena. Those of us in the earth sciences, and the reason that we focus on the earth sciences here, the earth sciences by practice for since our beginning 180, 200 years ago, has taken a global view of how our science is projected and used and interpreted. And Many of the geological or the earth science aspects, when we work overseas, in some ways we could say by definition we're carrying out some of the aims of science diplomacy. In the governance of the earth sciences at the international level, there are four international unions: the International Union of Geological Sciences, the International Union of Geodesy and Geophysics, the International Union of Soil Sciences, in the International Union of Quaternary Studies. Each of these international unions has a decidedly global perspective on the way the Earth works and the way scientists work overseas. And those four unions came together to propose and organize for you today this session on science diplomacy through the earth sciences. Ironically, tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of the International Union of Geological Sciences. There's a celebration in Paris, and so it was either be here or be in Paris, and many of us chose to be here, obviously. But the role of using the terms science diplomacy through the earth sciences is something that's taken on more and more of an allure, or at least a way of speaking about it. The science diplomacy that the President and that Secretary Gates discussed a few years ago and the actions taken by the administration really are focused at the policy level. And our discussant today, Dr. Bruce Alberts from the AAAS in Science Magazine, will say a little bit about that towards the end of the session today. What we're about today is science diplomacy through the earth sciences. We're going to be looking at six specific examples where we can perhaps draw some key lessons learned, look at some of the issues related to the challenges of working in science diplomacy through the earth sciences, and hopefully identify a set of what we might refer to as best practices for people interested in and pursuing science diplomacy through the earth sciences abroad. The U.S. Geological Survey has been around for about 131 years now, and particularly since World War II, the USGS has had a number of international programs with in-country presence, particularly in the Muslim world. Over the years since World War II, we've seen the establishment and disbanding of in-country missions to places like Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Pakistan, Indonesia. And if you think to yourself, well, those are the same countries that are in the world today, that are in the world media today on a very real basis. Well, the USGS has been working in a global context, but in those countries in particular over the last 60 years. So the USGS has a very strong interest in the earth sciences, and I mean earth sciences in the broadly written term, the hydrology, the geology, the resources, the ecosystem services, and particularly geographic information and geographic data. So today we're going to hear from six practitioners of science diplomacy in the earth sciences, and our first speaker today is Eric Calais. We're going to follow the six speakers as listed in your program. Professor Calais works at Purdue University. He obtained his doctorate at the University of Nice in France in 1991. He's specializing in the geodynamics of tectonic processes at plate boundaries and at plate interiors. And most recently, he's taken the position of science advisor to the United Nations Development Program, Disaster Risk Reduction Program in Haiti since August of 2010. So thank you. And first speaker is Eric.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm glad to be here and to have the opportunity to talk to such a distinguished audience. The official title of my talk is The Haiti Earthquake, a Science Diplomacy Opportunity, but the real title really is From the Trenches in Haiti, Diary of an Ignorant Scientist. I don't know much about diplomacy, science diplomacy. I know a little bit about science, so most of what I'm going to talk about today is really the day-to-day reflection of what I've learned trying to do my best in Haiti after the earthquake in terms of incorporating earthquake risk reduction into at least the thinking and, if possible, policies. I've been working as a science advisor for the UNDP, the UN Disaster Risk Reduction Program, since August. I'm also a professor of geophysics at Purdue, and nothing I'm saying here is either on behalf of UNDP or of Purdue University. These are my personal reflections. So it all starts with this picture really that I like because it shows Port-au-Prince. It shows this nice feature in the topography, which is the threat, the hazard, the fault line, the Enriquillo Fault. We know that it had earthquakes in the past. We know that it's active. It's building up seismic energy. We also know that next to it, within a few kilometers, is a major city, more than 3 million people, poorly prepared, overpopulated. Vulnerability plus threat, this is the recipe for disaster, and this is the recipe of the came into play on January 12th. 2010, magnitude 7 earthquake that hit southern Haiti. Port-au-Prince is right here, and you can see in red the area that has the most of the shaking. We know, we've seen over and over the consequences of this earthquake for the population and the economy of this country. We knew quite a bit before the earthquake, science-wise. For example, in 2008, Manacker and others published this sentence in JGI, the Enriquillo Fault, this guy here, which ruptured on January 12, 2010, is currently capable of a magnitude 7.2 earthquake if the entire elastic strain accumulated since the last major earthquake was released in a single event today. So we had a pretty good idea of what this fault was capable of doing. This was 2008, and this is actually a paper by a postdoc in my group, and we had opportunities to talk to the Haitian government, to talk to major donors in Haiti, to talk to bilateral corporations as well. And we really, I think, failed to pass this message that the threat was significant, and significant enough that measures had to be taken. And really the reason why I think I took that job for a year with the UN is to try to understand why did we fail and what can we do or what can I do in the rest of my career so that we don't fail again or at least not so miserably. The competition is hard when you work on earthquakes, in particular in tropical countries, because hurricanes are a prominent source of hazard. And I remember one time talking a few years ago, in 2008, talking to the Prime Minister of Haiti and explaining the threat, and he was very polite and he listened. He said, "Okay, well, when is the next earthquake going to happen?" And I said, "Well, you know, science can tell us." "Oh, okay. So what do you propose?" And then I started saying, "Well, you know, it's a long-term effort. It's complex. I'll stop you right here. I know when the hurricane season starts. It starts in June. It ends in October. Over the past 4 years, we've lost 25% of our GDP with hurricanes. What do you think I should do?" And, of course, a lot of the money and efforts are going into hurricane preparedness and response, which is a good thing because progress has been made. But at the same time, in 35 seconds of shaking, the country has lost 100% of its GDP, more than 200,000 people, and more than 2 million people affected. And this is the most destructive event a country has ever experienced in terms of people killed in one single country by one single event. So the status of earthquake science and engineering in Haiti before the earthquake was, of course, very, very low. It still is, and this is something we have to work on if we want any progress to be made. No seismologists, no seismic monitoring network, even though the island is cut through by two major fault lines. Very bad earthquake hazard map. The best geological map is old, no construction code, no earthquake preparedness, no geoscience curriculum. 84% of the post-high school population leaves Haiti and never returns. This is the first number one country in the world in that ranking. Number two is Ghana with 49%. 76% of the population below poverty line, et cetera, et cetera. You can read that yourself. So obviously, when you're facing such a list, such a daunting list, the priority is not how much strain is building up on the Enriquillo Fault. It's really how do you reduce poverty via development. And that may be an entryway for the work I want to do there in terms of earthquake preparedness. The other thing is that there is a lack of local capacity to take the lead in earthquake risk reduction in Haiti, and until that changes, it's going to be very difficult to make any progress. Another side of the story which I discovered after I started this job is to look at the international perspective on these things. The international community is very, very present in Haiti in terms of dollars, in terms of physical presence, and so on. So a fair question to ask, I guess, if I was a donor is, should I invest in seismic risk reduction in Haiti? And to get the answer, I would go to the UNISDR, for example, website, Prevention Web. You can go there right now if you want. And I would look for Haiti. What's the exposure of the country? Human exposure to cyclones. This is still online, I think. Drought, flood, landslide, earthquakes. 13,950 people. Economic exposure, same thing, 0.04 GDP, it's two orders of magnitudes off compared to the cost of the earthquake. And earthquake vulnerability and risk is in the green and the low to very low. So obviously the answer is no. I don't want to point fingers here at this study as much as really I want to point out this question here. Where are the scientists? Why are they not informing the process? And this is a question for myself. What have I been doing? Why did I read this website only last year and not 5 years ago? So I did a little more research, and it's interesting from a seismological standpoint because this is another study, the so-called hotspot studies. And when you look at the data that is used to calculate the exposure that I showed earlier, for Haiti, for example, frequency of earthquakes for the past 40 years or so. You have a map of earthquakes, large earthquakes in Haiti. Earthquakes don't happen very often, which is a good thing. There hasn't been any large earthquake in 40 years in Haiti. So, of course, with this prerequisite, you're going to completely miss the point by definition. The other thing is the global seismic hazard map, which is not very accurate. You can see that you don't need to know what this means. The contours are north-south, and the fault lines are east-west. This already is enough for a Geology 101 student to realize that there's a problem there. So disaster risk management specialists should take Seismology 101, but at the same time, again, seismologists, people like me, haven't been paying attention, and I think this is a big challenge and a big opportunity also if we want to change things. So After the Haiti earthquake, during the first few days, scientists were on the front line trying to figure out what was going on. Of course, there was a lot going on in the country itself in terms of search and rescue operation and so on. The first 3 weeks was a preparation for on-site science and engineering surveys. A seismic task force was put in place by the UN at the time, and that task force briefed the UN and the government of Haiti as well. In February, March, the World Bank and the UN put together the post-disaster needs assessment that follows every major catastrophe on the planet, and just geophysical surveys started to be occurring. Mid-March was important. There was a meeting, a science and engineering meeting in Haiti, where the vague concept of a need for a national earthquake risk reduction program in Haiti, for Haiti, was put forward. And in April, the government of Haiti actually solicited UN support to define and implement that program or that strategy. In August, the UN, in response to this solicitation, hired a science advisor placed within UNDP, and that's me. And when I have to explain to my colleagues what I do, the first thing I tell them, because they always tell me, oh, so you're in Haiti all the time now, so you must be, you know, doing more geodetic measurements and going to the fault line. I said, no, I don't do any science. I don't even implement any of the latest scientific results. I simply want to make sure that the basic science and engineering we know for sure are taken into account and that the basic needs are covered. And in many ways, the role I try to play there is the role of a matchmaker between international assistance and the in-country capacity, and making sure in particular that international partners work through the national institutions and have capacity building built in their programs. So the way I used to be thinking was like this as a scientist, and I'll get back to that mode of thinking in a few months, hopefully. Proposal formulation leads to proposal funding, implementation of a project, data analysis, we publish and we keep going in circle like this. And switching mode, I was thinking that maybe in the world of policy or whatever the cycle would be agenda setting, policy formulation, decision making, implementation, evaluation, and so on and so forth. Which may be true, but of course there are in Haiti government, donors, UN system, NGOs, civil society, private sector. The government of Haiti has a lot to say at every step of the process here. Obviously, the UN system as well being very much involved, and donors as well, civil society, private sector, and NGOs. The good thing is that they talk to each other. The NGOs talk to the UN, to the government, to civil society, and the government replies, and here we go. So this is what I have to deal with on a daily basis, and it's quite overwhelming, and I have a lot of respect for people who do this for a living. Anyways, three examples now on how science was important and is important in the earthquake risk reduction process in Haiti. That's three different timescales. The timescale of the response, so the first few days to few weeks after the event. The issue then, and I got to Haiti within, I think, a week after the earthquake. One of the issues then was the heterogeneity of resources. There was a lot coming at decision makers. A lot of the sources were not really verified. There was good thing, a lot of academic interest and input, but quite disorganized. So the role a scientist played at the time was acting as a filter, reality checking and briefings. The local expertise was totally overwhelmed. There was a lot of pressure from aid agencies, in particular the UN. This is what's left of the UN headquarters. It's pretty much gone. And in particular, questions such as, where do we relocate? Should we leave the country? Should we move to Florida? What's the next step? And also a lot of pressure from the media to explain what happened and why. Every step of this process here, science has a very important role to play. The second time frame is a time frame of the recovery, so the first few months, and right now we are kind of in between the recovery and the reconstruction. Scientists have a very important role to play there on advice and best practices. Some of it was done by private enterprises. Some of it has been driven by academics, in particular seminars for engineers, geotechnical mapping to help guide the reconstruction has started to occur there. Some key science products that were produced at that during that time is the seismic hazard map done by the USGS. Very important to guide the reconstruction, because you know the amount of shaking that the whole country is likely to be subjected to in earthquakes to come. Post-earthquake surveys at the science. What happened during the earthquake? What is a hazard today? Did it change? Did it increase? Did it decrease? Seismic macrozonation of Port-au-Prince, this map here, what is the soil quality? As Port-au-Prince is going to be rebuilt, should it be rebuilt here in the pink, or should we rebuild in the blue here? A seismic monitoring network was started to be put in place as well. So a lot going on that's essential, where science has an input, and that's essential for the long-term well-being of earthquakes, for the earthquake resilience of Haiti. And last but not least, the initiation of partnerships between Haitian institutions and international partners. The long-term needs are in terms of the reconstruction timeframes, they're fairly well known. The conventional recipe would be Hyogo framework of action. You want to identify the hazard, train and educate, use information to prevent and mitigate, prepare and respond, and mainstream risk reduction into policies. It's a great framework. In practice, it's not that easy to apply, in particular in a country like Haiti. It requires a coordinated framework, and there is nothing like that yet in Haiti, a place for one-stop shopping for international assistance, and also a national platform where national institutions can share information, evaluate projects, and coordinate actions. There are challenges, lots of challenges. Here are some of them here. The main one in Haiti is the economy. This is GDP as a function of time in Haiti. Obviously, you can read the major political events over the past 20 years in Haiti. Obviously, GDP is a function of the political events. And it's interesting to see that the seven major hurricanes that caused 25% of Haiti's GDP occurred in the period of greatest GDP growth. So if GDP is a function of politics and not natural disasters, why bother? That's a question that remains open to me. Governance is a big question in Haiti, obviously. Institutional mandates are not respected. There is the chain of commands is very unclear. And a lot of that is a result of low resources, intense inter-institutional competition leading to mission creep, an institution stepping onto another institution's toes and doing somebody else's mission because they realize that's where the money is for tomorrow. And coordination in that framework is often seen as a hindrance because if you coordinate with your competitors, it means dilutions of resources as well. Capacity is a question as well. There's no champion of earthquake risk reduction in Haiti yet, and this is something that we have to build. This is something that the scientific community, the international scientific community, has a very important role to play in. Proposals are never evaluated in Haiti. If you show up with a proposal, if there is money attached to it, it's going to go through. The approach is take the money and run, really. And all of that is a consequence. I think that it is really a country in survival mode, in which case vision, planning, follow-up, coordination, all those things that we like to do in other countries is really a luxury. There are also external challenges. There are many outside actors in Haiti, not so much in earthquake hazard, but in other areas of disaster risk reductions. The international partners are not always working through the national system. Sometimes they don't even work with the national system. They want to stay under the radar because they think it's simpler to get to achieve their goals. There is a culture of projects, which was bad between 2010, and it has worsened. This map illustrates that here for watershed management. You see the different watersheds with one colored circle per funding agency. There's a lot of overlap, a lot of duplication, and a lot of these are projects, like a two-year project, $5 million. Project is done, sustainability, in most cases, not achieved. And that has to change. NGOs are out of control. Some, not all, but some are. And there is the issue that I have to deal with on a daily basis, which is the agenda of donors and the competition between donors and how to find my way through this. So a lot of what I see on a daily basis, and I apologize if this is a little blunt, but I see a lot of international arrogance in the field there. We know the solution. Let's export it. And one example that I heard recently was an agency, which I won't name, that sent me the proposal, and I told them, well, don't send it to me. Send it to the Haitian institution. And said, well, we wanted to share it with we wanted to do that, but we're sorry, the proposal is due next week, so we can't. I don't think that's the right way to go. Anyways, there are some good examples, even though there are challenges. And this is an example that I like. It's technical in a way. It's the example of seismic microzonation. Microzonation means that you need maps of the susceptibility of the ground to seismic shaking before you build as you plan. You're not going to build a hospital in the same way, depending on the ground character, the soil characteristics, and its vulnerability to shaking. So the way this worked is that the Ministry for Public Works in Haiti wanted to do that, and they wanted to do that before the earthquake. But they're engineers, and the way they think about microzonation is in terms of response spectrum, which is something that most of you have no idea what it is. And I'm not an engineer, and I have a vague idea of what it means, but very difficult to sell. So they contacted UNDP, and we worked with them, we thought that the way to sell it maybe would be through urban planning. And as you do urban planning, eventually you'll get to a response spectrum as well, but you don't have to mention that word. We therefore contacted the Ministry for Planning, with which they hadn't talked at all in the past few years about this product. And after some other discussion, the end result is that the Ministry of Planning, the government of Haiti, on their own budget, is funding that study in partnership with the Ministry of Public Works. There is technology transfer involved because this will be done by an international consortium. And now the donor is interested in contributing. And actually, we had to tell them, well, sorry, we have the money to do it, or the government told them we have the money to do it. We don't need you, at least in this first phase, but, you know, stay in touch. We'll need more money later. And the other thing is that this created a buzz, because microzonation is technical in nature, but it's really an alibi to keep earthquake hazard on top of the agenda in the country. There are a number of positive indicators in Haiti, and you can read all of them here, and I won't go through all of them, but what's important is that a lot of them start with government of Haiti orders. So the government of Haiti is now aware of the issue, and they want to move forward. And, of course, with advice from outside, they are moving forward. Even the Interim Commission for the Reconstruction of Haiti so-called Clinton Commission, or Clinton-Bellerive Commission, is also being proactive about all this. There are still concerns, however. The Commission approves projects still, as we speak, without earthquake safety as a prerequisite, and we need to change that. The lack of trust persists. There are still international partners who don't want to work through institutions, to national institutions as equal partners. I think it's a key to sustainability, and some are still refusing to do that. And in Haiti, there is a lot of resistance still to coordination. The long-term political will for disaster risk reduction in Haiti is also at stake. There are presidential elections coming up. We're in the middle of between two runs right now. The societal will is another for disaster risk reduction. To me, is a big question as well. The way people look at this is that their life hasn't really improved at all since the earthquake. So again, disaster risk reduction to the population remains a hard sell. So in conclusion, I would say that if I look at this from a higher perspective, I think one of the overarching problems I've discovered, and a lot of this may be obvious to you, I'm sorry here if I'm stating the obvious, but top scientists, or scientists in general, are very absent from the international disaster risk management scene, where a lot is going on that we don't know about and we don't bother inform. International agencies interested in disaster risk reduction, some of them at least, do not quite understand the value of science. And I can speak from my own agency, UNDP. It's really hard on a daily basis to explain to them the value, to my colleagues, which are very smart people, the interest of earthquake risk reduction in particular. But we're making progress. We're making progress. Translating science into policy obviously starts with a scientist. I think that's obvious. But scientists willing to go the extra mile of building capacity at the core of the partnerships, working, again, I insist on that, with and through national institutions. And also, and that's for scientists is difficult, but I've learned my lesson, except that decisions are not driven by science most of the time. They're driven by consideration. There are other than scientific, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be trying to be part of the process. I think that in the end, science is really a key to sustainability, in particular in developing countries, in a country like Haiti. First of all, because it's cheap. A seismic network for Haiti costs about 5 kilometers of freeway. You can do the math. And also because the motivation to sustain efforts as a scientist is always beyond the economy and the political difficulties. And I'll end with this one sentence here that I like a lot that was said by a Haitian PhD geologist who, and I think it puts things in perspective, and you can think over it as when I'm done. He said one day, two Haitian mistakes are worth more than one international truth. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eric. We have time for one question. What the format will be, after the first three speakers, we'll do a brief question and answer period, comment period, and then we'll have the final three speakers. So please, if you would go to the microphone also, and if you'd state your name and your question, that'd be great.
Hi, I'm Chantal Damas, and I'm actually working with Anik. We went to Haiti, and I'm a physicist by training. I'm originally from Haiti. I grew up here. So my question is, we went to Haiti trying to work with the institutions, so the state university, and we've met with the scientists and engineers to build capacity. And what we found is that it's very difficult to really understand what's happening, and coordination is a very big problem. And like you said, working within the institution is very important because that's how you really build sustainability in the long run. So I guess my question is, how can we really work with these institutions such as the universities? Because, like you said, people just tend to bypass them because either nobody trusts what they have to do or it's just arrogance that nobody thinks that the universities can do anything. Thank you.
Yeah, well, that's a million-dollar question in many ways, and there is no straight answer to it. I think one of the big issues in Haiti with institutions, government institutions, is that a lot of their staff, it's a very basic problem. Most of the staff, for example, 95% of the professors teaching at the state university are not full-time employees of the university. Only 5% of the professors on staff are paid full-time, probably $3,000 a month or so to teach there. So until this hasn't changed, it's going to be very difficult to have a dialogue with institutions. And the same is true with other institutions. And I'm not sure where you start this with to push to jumpstart this process, but I think we still have to be patient. It's not because institutions are not functional or because people don't have time to work with you that you should stop trying to communicate with them. They work on a different time scale, so they didn't reply to your emails. Try again. I'm not sure that's the right answer, but. Yes, right. That's a whole other question. Okay.
Thank you. Thanks. Our next speaker is Dr. Julie Coonan from the U.S. Agency for International Development. Julie's the senior advisor for the Bureau of Policy, Planning, and Learning at USAID here in Washington. She's also the Bureau's lead on environmental policy advisor and is playing a key role in managing the agency's global change initiative. Julie was formerly a AAAS policy fellow, science policy fellow in 2003, and she has her doctoral degree from the University of Arizona. And so, Julie?
Let me see.
Is there a little...
Good afternoon. I want to start by thanking the organizers of the panel for inviting me to join because I am not an earth scientist. So I appreciate the fact that the definition was broadened so that I could come and talk today about some of the work that AID does in the area of biodiversity conservation and natural resource management. So today I'm going to talk about a couple of collaborations between scientists and development practitioners at USAID. I'll discuss two projects that I've been involved in where development goals were met through the important contributions of scientists in a whole bunch of different disciplines. And as importantly, the point that I'll make is that scientific research done in the context of development yields important insights and advances that I think push the discipline and really advance the state of the art in the various scientific fields that that I'll be speaking about. So before diving into my two examples, I'm just going to provide a little bit of background about how the Obama administration sees science and technology and innovation as contributing to foreign policy goals. So just a few weeks ago, I'm sure a lot of you heard the president speak in his State of the Union address, and one of the most important themes, obviously, was innovation. He spoke about innovation as a driver of the nation's economy, as an important part of our global leadership as a nation. He spent quite a bit of time in that speech talking about things like the clean economy of the future, energy, infrastructure, math, science, education, the importance of investing in those areas to reclaim our nation's primacy in innovation. Pursuit of excellence in science and innovation is obviously not just about economics. The president's national security strategy also emphasizes excellence in discovery and innovation as a security issue. And the national security strategy specifically cites scientific partnerships and international scientific and technological collaboration as a critical tool in preserving America's global leadership. So narrowing down just a little bit to my area, I work in development, obviously. Some of you may be aware that President Obama has issued the first ever presidential directive on global development. We've never had one before. And this directive recognizes development, together with diplomacy and defense, as one of the three pillars of American foreign policy. It was a really good day for my agency when that came out. The global development policy calls on the U.S. to achieve its development goals by focusing on a very small number of core objectives. And importantly for us, game-changing innovation was one of those core areas. There's really only six objectives that are defined in the development policy. Innovation science is one of those. So turning now to my agency, AID itself, some of you may know that the current administrator of AID is himself a scientist. Dr. Raj Shah is a doctor. He has a tremendous background in public health as well as in agriculture and food security. And Dr. Shah has very ambitious goals for my agency, especially in the area of science and technology. He's brought a tremendous focus on rebuilding our agency's expertise in these areas. We have a very long history of distinguished work in these fields, and we had slipped a little bit past years. So among the accomplishments thus far is the reestablishment of an Office of Science and Technology, which is directed by my friend and colleague who's in the room next door, Dr. Alex Dagan, who is speaking on a panel this afternoon. So the reform agenda that Dr. Shah is leading, it's called AID Forward, has an explicit goal around science and technology, and the goal is to transform AID into a global leader in development by pioneering science, technological, research-oriented, and innovative approaches to traditional development challenges. So I think the key message there for us is that we can't solve development challenges without the contributions of science. There are a number of efforts that AID is launching towards this goal, including grand challenges in development. The first one of those is on global health. New partnerships with federal agencies such as the National Science Foundation, NASA, USGS, and a program to rebuild the scientific expertise in the agency, not the least by regrowing the robust AAAS fellowship program that the agency has had. I am a former AAAS fellow. The co-organizer of the panel is a former AAAS fellow, and next year we hope to have more than 40 AAAS fellows at the agency, which is a huge uptick in numbers. We had gone as low as two, so this is really quite an advance. So I think by now I've made it clear why the president, why his administration, and why my agency cares a lot about science. But I think the more important question is why should science and scientists care about development? So today I want to focus on two reasons why I think science really needs to care about development. First, probably most obviously, science and scientists contribute a tremendous amount to development goals, right? Their work reduces death, prevents the spread of disease, reduces malnutrition, reduces hunger, offers opportunities for education, for better livelihoods for people all over the world. But I think, secondly, by working in developing country contexts and in collaboration with development practitioners and towards development goals, the practice of science, the state of the art of the discipline, evolves and advances. And I'm going to focus today on two examples of collaboration among scientists and development specialists that I think illustrate these points. In both cases, the first one is a biodiversity conservation program that I worked on in the Bolivian Amazon, and the second is a conservation program that involves archaeological research, tourism, sustainable forestry in northern Guatemala. In both of these cases, the development goals of the activity could not have been achieved without the contributions both of American scientists and scientists from the country where we were working. And in both cases, the practice of conservation science and archaeology, the two fields that I'll focus on, changed to recognize that neither discipline could be practiced successfully in a vacuum in these countries. And without regard to local communities, local values, local practices, and importantly, I think, local uses of both the natural and cultural resources in these places. So now you get to the prettier photo slides. So in Bolivia, USAID supported a landmark effort by a group of indigenous people known as the Tacana to gain recognition by the Bolivian government of their traditional lands and to develop and implement a visionary, really, there's a copy of it, a sustainable development plan for their people that was based on the management of natural resources in their traditional territory. So keep your eye on the crocodile. That's the caiman, the alligator at the bottom left. I'll talk about why the alligator is actually important to this story. So this program with the Tacana is now part of a larger USAID initiative that I used to help manage, the Initiative for Conservation in the Andean Amazon. And one thing that's unique about this program is that it focuses on supporting local organizations. This is something Eric was just talking about. The point is to support the organizations to develop their own capacities to sustainably use and conserve one of the world's most biodiverse regions. I'm talking about the western part of the Amazon basin where it meets the tropical Andes. So, in other words, if you look at ICA, you can see that it has a sort of nested set of goals. Some of them are at the, you know, global public good biodiversity level, some of them are at the national level, and some of them are at the local level. But in all cases, what we're focusing on is building sustainable systems in these countries and building the capacity of local organizations to conduct this work themselves so that long after the donors go home, this work can continue. So drilling down a little bit into this project, we work in consortia, and I'm going to talk today just about one of the consortia. In this case, it is led by the Wildlife Conservation Society, which is a U.S.-based organization, but they have a local Bolivian office, in partnership with three local NGOs that are listed here at the bottom. The one on the far right, SPDA, is the Society for Peruvian Environmental Law. Amazon Conservation Association is a Peruvian-based local NGO, and Fondo de las Americas is the Debt for Nature Swap Trust Fund that was put into place when the U.S. forgave Peruvian debt. Okay, so this is the area that I'm talking about right here. This is on the border between Bolivia and Peru. This is the Amazon Basin, the Western Andes right here. Okay. So this landscape is anchored by two national parks, Manu National Park here in Peru, Medidi National Park here in Bolivia. And there's a landscape corridor that's very important to preserve between them. For anyone who knows a little bit about biodiversity conservation, the park alone is never enough, really, to preserve the biodiversity that's located there. What we're trying to do is build sustainable landscapes and to link a conservation corridor sort of through this area. And what this consortium really figured out is that this can only be done successfully by working intimately with the indigenous groups and other resource users in this zone, focusing very intently on land management planning. It's one of the real precursor activities to any good biodiversity conservation project. And that requires a whole suite of scientific studies, studies of the ecosystems, species population, the condition of the natural resources themselves, and then working with local people, local communities, to find sustainable alternatives to income generation. And the local people themselves have to identify those options and decide that they're priorities themselves. Otherwise, I don't think we'd succeed. So this area, I think people know, is, or maybe you know, the Amazon is one of the world's most biodiverse landscapes. It's also one of the world's highly threatened landscapes. And right now, road development, development of dams, illegal mining, even legal mining, oil and gas exploration, deforestation, wildlife poaching are a whole suite of threats that this landscape is suffering from. And the Tacana people who live in northern Bolivia right here on the border of Medidi National Park have really been pioneers in Bolivia in very difficult political circumstances, I could also add off the record. Have really been pioneers in sort of successful advocacy for legal recognition of their territory and a sustainable management plan that's based on their resources and the sound management of their resources. So this is where the Cayman comes in case you thought maybe I'd forgotten about it. So these are the spectacled Cayman right here. This is the end product of what you sometimes do with a Cayman. Their leather is highly desirable. And there has been a long history of hunting of Cayman by local populations to the point that they were considered to be highly threatened, and they were listed on Appendix 2 of CITES, the Convention on Trade in Endangered Species. So once you're listed on Appendix 2, you're required to conduct really rigorous studies of the population in order to demonstrate that any further hunting for export will not further undermine the viability of the local population. And this is what the Bolivian government decided to do. In 1995, they instituted a sustainable management system for this species of Cayman. This is the spectacled Cayman, not the black Cayman, which continues to be highly endangered. And as part of this sustainable development strategy, the Tacana themselves identified sustainable harvest and the managed harvest as a potentially viable livelihood option for themselves. So the Consejo Indígena del Pueblo Tacana, that's CIPTA, the acronym that I'll be using, that's the legal representative of the Tacana people and the organization that holds the collective title to the Tacana indigenous territory. CIPTA requested that the Wildlife Conservation Society and its scientists help them to establish this income stream by conducting all the necessary biological studies, and then worked with them to develop the necessary planning, training, recovery of traditional hunting practices, and identification of markets that would allow them to utilize this natural resource as part of their sustainability plan for their people. So among the studies that the scientists conducted were population censuses, delineation of zones for harvest for no-take areas, a pilot management plan, establishment of a harvest quota on the basis of these studies. The current program, which CIPTA now manages itself, has a full-scale government-approved management plan. They conduct monitoring, publication of all of the data, sharing of lessons learned from this practice. They have organized and trained all of the harvesters. There's a transparent plan for sharing of the benefits, the financial benefits that accrue from this activity. And there's a data registry, as I mentioned, for all of the harvested individuals. You can see some of the data being gathered here by the local Tacana themselves. There are a whole series of groups of locally trained individuals, including students in the biology program at the local university, and the WCS scientists who live in Bolivia, all participate in ongoing studies of animal health, genetics, diet, parasitology, et cetera, as part of the monitoring, the research and monitoring program. Okay, so turning now to my second example, and one very dear to my heart. This is the area where I did my dissertation research. This is a project that involves not only conservation biologists, as in Bolivia, but also archaeologists and a whole group of other scientists in a long-standing program that USAID has supported to conserve the Maya Biosphere Reserve in the Petén region of Guatemala. So the Maya Biosphere Reserve, this is a map of Guatemala. We're in the northern part of Guatemala here. This is the Petén region of Guatemala. This is the Biosphere Reserve. It's sort of a funny-looking map. But this white kind of snaky part of it here, this is the buffer zone of the biosphere reserve. So if you're familiar at all with biosphere reserves, they have core protected areas, they have multiple use areas, and then they have buffer zones. And the buffer zone is designed to really preclude or to prevent really intense human impact on the core area of the zone from intruding, so you can see that it's arrayed along the southern flank of the reserve. The green areas are protected areas, various kinds. And then this beige area here is the multiple use area. So the unique thing about the Maya Biosphere Reserve is that it's renowned both for its unbelievable biodiversity. It contains the last largest intact piece of the Maya forest. And it is also the heart of ancient Maya civilization. It has extremely famous archaeological sites like Tikal, which is right here at the bottom. So I'm going to talk a little bit today about what's going on in this park over here. This is Laguna del Tigre National Park. It's on the western border of Guatemala with Mexico. And it is not only an important forested area, an important home to archaeological sites, but it also contains some of Guatemala's most important wetlands, and it's one of the most important sites in the world as nesting habitat for the scarlet macaw, which is right here. So the sad thing about the Biosphere Reserve is it's under incredible threat, and right now the biggest threat is drug smuggling. There's a lot of trafficking in wildlife, trafficking in cultural artifacts. This is a looted ceramic pot that has come out of an archaeological site. And if you've ever seen a looted archaeological site, or if you haven't, this is what happens. The looters come and they just dig a big trench right down the middle of a temple because they know that the ancient Maya buried royal and elite people right in the center on the cross axes of the temple. So they just dig straight through and then haul out all the nice artifacts and sell them on the international art market. And what also happens very unusually in Guatemala is there's this concept of narco ganaderos, which are narco ranchers. And what goes on is that the narcos pay poor people to go in illegally to protected areas and to clear land by setting fire to it. And then they just set up all these sort of illegal ranches. And the smoke from the fires hides from the aerial view all the illicit airstrips that are dotted all over the place where the planes transporting cocaine from Colombia land on their way to the U.S. So they're landing on the border between Mexico and Guatemala, and they're shipping the drugs overland from there up into North America. And this is why you see the Guatemalan army right here patrolling. Okay. So what do we do about this? It's a huge problem, and I actually don't have a heat map of the fires in my presentation, but if you were to look at a heat map of fires over the last sort of 10 years or so, you would see that on the western flank of the Maya Biosphere Reserve, seasonally, there's just a tremendous amount of fire that's causing huge devastation to the biodiversity. It's damaging some of the archaeological sites, and it's threatening the health of the people that live there. So what to do about this? About a year ago, David Friedel, who's an American archaeologist, that's him right there, he is the co-director with Hector Escobedo, who's right here, who is currently Guatemala's Minister of Culture. They're the co-directors of an archaeological project at a site in Laguna del Tigre Park. It's called the Huaca Archaeological Project. The site is known as El Perú. So David gave me a call and said, look, you know, the advance of this narco-trafficking front into Guatemala is not only threatening the park, it's threatening the site, it's threatening the safety of our researchers. So, you know, can the U.S. government help us with this? And I give David and Hector all the credit in the world. They were really willing to take some unconventional steps to counter the threat that was facing them. I mean, they're researchers, right? It's not their job to sort of go around enforcing laws or to fight this trafficking battle. But they were willing to do it because they really, really cared about the damage that was happening in the park. But they needed some unusual allies, really, to fight this battle, and so they gave me a call. We convened a meeting at the State Department. David came up for it. Rowan McNabb, who was in the previous slide, he was the one holding the ceramic pot. He's a scientist and the country director for Wildlife Conservation Society in Guatemala. He came up as well. And we met with the State Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement, the people who work on drugs and thugs at the State Department. And we made the case to them. We presented the argument that narcotics trafficking was not only a threat in the traditional law enforcement sense, that they, obviously the INL folks, were very familiar with. It was a language they were used to speaking. But it was also a threat to the natural heritage and the cultural heritage of the Biosphere Reserve, and that the Biosphere Reserve itself was designed to protect. And also, it was a threat to the assets that northern Guatemala was really depending on for its development. So there was a whole sort of suite of things that a lot of different people with different interests could really get behind in this case. And what we argued was that scientific researchers like David and Hector and Rowan, who are a nearly permanent presence in the field, can serve as deterrents to this illegal activity if they're properly organized, if they're backed up by law enforcement, and if they're willing to work in partnership with the local communities, who are also, of course, permanent residents in these conflictive areas, but often have very little power on their own. And so what we ended up doing was USAID formed a partnership with the Guatemalan government. the Department of Interior, which has a kind of sister park relationship, Wildlife Conservation Society, the Archaeological Project, and a bunch of local conservation groups. And we developed a two-prong strategy to preserve the biosphere reserve. So on the one side, we were working to contain the expansion of this drug-driven, what we call the agro-pastoral frontier. This is basically the frontier of deforestation through fire as more and more ranches were placed into the biosphere reserve. So working on that front, on the western side of the biosphere reserve, on the flanks of the park, and then working to protect the relatively intact forests on the eastern side of the part of the reserve, which were under less threat and had a potential more viable sort of other types of strategies. So this is known as the SHIELD strategy, and it promoted permanent field research presence at the various archaeological sites where David and his team were working. We also established some permanent field research presence at the most important macaw nesting sites. And then on the eastern side of the reserve, we worked with a group of community forestry concessions. This is a group of people that AID has been working with for over 10 years, who organized themselves. They have concessions from the Guatemalan government to extract timber in an environmentally responsible way. It's timber that's certified by the Rainforest Alliance and then exported to various countries like the U.S. And this is an activity that allows these people to generate significant revenue in a legal manner. It provides an alternative to some of the other illegal ways that people sometimes generate their income in this part of the world. And these local concessionaires also built and voluntarily manned checkpoints along the road. And this is one here that they built themselves. This is the entrance to one of the concessions on the western, on the eastern side of Guatemala near the Belize border. And it's important to man these checkpoints because the roads obviously are used for the extraction of the timber, but they can also be used for a lot of illegal activity. So the patrols are there to regulate the ingress into these concessions. And this is also very important for the safety of tourists because a lot of tourists come to the Biosphere Reserve to visit the archaeology, to see the really incomparable wildlife in the park. But it can be a little bit dangerous on the road. So we think the strategy is working. I wouldn't say that the battle is over, but I would say that this really unconventional partnership among the researchers, law enforcement agencies, the development agencies, and the local communities is starting to yield some benefits. I think citizen safety has improved, income generation is up, tourism continues, the archaeological sites are better protected, the biodiversity is being a little bit protected. This is a map that the National Protected Areas Service of Guatemala published last year, and the green areas are all the areas that they've recovered from the narcos and from the local people that the narcos had hired to basically go in and illegally settle in the core and multi-use areas of the biosphere reserve where permanent settlement is not permitted, is not legal. So they're making a little bit of progress. Okay, so this is my last slide. So I just want to quickly summarize a couple of the lessons that I think are important for scientists to think about in the area of science diplomacy. So first, I think that scientists should recognize that scientific goals and development goals are not in opposition. And this may not sound like a novel kind of conclusion to you, but in the area of biodiversity conservation, this is a relatively new, you know, last couple of decades kind of realization. Conserving natural resources and providing options for development to local communities have to go hand in hand. So conservation no longer means, you know, establishing a protected area and locking the biodiversity up inside the park and not allowing anybody to have access to it. And now most mainstream conservation groups really recognize the integral role that local people like the Tacana in Bolivia play to achieve conservation goals. And they see local populations and local communities as partners in this effort. Second, I think that scientists are finding more common ground with policymakers and are speaking directly to them about their concerns in a language that policymakers themselves understand. So David Friedel took it upon himself in this unconventional way to recognize that his research could be supported by finding allies and finding a common ground on which they could stand. So the law enforcement folks at State Department didn't really care about archaeology, to be totally honest with you, and most of them told us they didn't even know what a scarlet macaw was. But they understood the drug threat, and they realized that they could make common cause against it because David had presented the argument in the language that they understood. And I think that that's very important for scientists working in this field to be able to do. Finally, more and more researchers, I think, are forming coalitions with a broad range of other specialists and finding that multidimensional research projects can be successful by addressing the same challenge from a variety of different angles. So in the Biosphere Project alone, we have archaeologists, foresters, biologists, paleoethnobotanists, geomorphologists, zooarchaeologists, botanists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, working together along with local producer associations, non-timber forest product collector groups, fire brigades, local patrols, law enforcement, sometimes even the Army. Partnerships such as these advance scientific goals, they address development challenges, and most importantly, they build new constituencies in support of the work that we're all trying to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Julie. We have time for one question for Julie at this part of the presentation. Please come to the microphone and identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Jessica Robin from the National Science Foundation. I was really intrigued by your example from Guatemala, and I was wondering, in that particular case, you had the support of the Guatemalan government. Have you any thoughts of how to pursue a similar type of model, or has USAID pursued such a model with a country like Bolivia, which would also have similar problems with drug trafficking and the coca production, but the relationship with the Bolivian and U.S. government is a little bit different?
So, I mean, I think the Bolivian example actually is an example of a case where certain entities or certain portions of the Bolivian government are not incredibly disposed to be collaborative with the U.S. government. So what we find, and usually in those cases, that you have to work at a different level of the government. So what we've done in Bolivia is seek out departmental-level government, municipal-level government, and really local-level government and made, you know, and found partnerships because what I find, at least in that context, is that, you know, the rhetoric is sort of up here at the national level, but people down here, you know, want to see the management get done. And so, I mean, obviously we would never work in a country where we were, you know, country non grata, and we are still working in Bolivia because we still are able to function there. But, yeah, I mean, what I would say across the board is that we work at a subnational regional level, and we can usually try to find ways to be productive there.
Great. Thank you, Julie. Our next speaker is Jeff Dobrik from the U.S. Geological Survey. And thank you for Jeff's straight up. Oh, there we go. Great. Jeff is the currently the the Associate Director for our Mineral Resources Program. He's been with the USGS for nearly 30 years. His undergraduate and graduate degrees are from the Colorado School of Mines. As we'll see with probably a number of people who have worked overseas, Jeff is an example of someone who, in his early childhood, actually lived in the Middle East, and later in his early survey career, worked as the Chief Scientist for the USGS mission in Saudi Arabia, from 1996 to 2001. From 2003 to 2006, he coordinated the USGS non-fuel resource assessment of Afghanistan. And from 2009-2010, he was the project manager for all USGS activities in Iraq. So we want to welcome Jeff for his presentation. There we go.
Thanks, Tom, and good afternoon, everyone. You can see that the title of my presentation there, perhaps an alternative title would be Science, Diplomacy, and Conflict Zones, which clearly conflict zones offer unique challenges as well as opportunities. I'll be focusing mostly on Iraq in this presentation, though I will touch upon some of our ongoing work in Afghanistan near the end. Project background with regards to Iraq, this work was conducted, supported by the Department of Defense Task Force for Business and Stability Operations, which I'll just refer to as Task Force from here on out. We began negotiations with the task force in early 2009. We conducted a couple of scoping missions in April and June of 2009 to see if project work in Iraq was really viable. We decided that it was, and officially began in October of 2009, what we thought was going to be a two-year project. However, the project ended prematurely in just last September because DOD funding prioritization had shifted to Afghanistan. Nevertheless, we were able to accomplish a great deal, and it's that I'd like to talk to you about this afternoon. Our final products are still coming out and will be coming out throughout this year. We conducted our program based with two bases of operation. Our main base of operation was out of Baghdad. Our second, what we call northern base of operations, was up here in Erbil, in the northern Kurdistan autonomous region of Iraq. And I just want to very briefly just give you some flavor of the conditions in which we were operated out of those two bases. This is looking down onto Baghdad. You can see the Tigris flowing through Bayab, Baghdad International Airport. IZ is the international zone where we based operations out of. That's where embassies and the Iraqi parliament and so forth are concentrated in this fortified zone here. And just for reference, there's the infamous Sadr City up there. When one comes into Baghdad, they fly into Baghdad International Airport, and we're met by a security detail with armored vehicles that then takes us from the airport into the international zone. The international zone is basically a concrete fortified zone, concrete jungle, if you will. Much of the work that we did in Baghdad with other Iraqi agencies and ministries was outside of the IZ, so in what they call the red zone. So every time we had to go meet with them, we did take a private security detail. And our field office was within the task force compound within the IZ and conveniently located right next to the restaurant. And living accommodations, trailers are what they call CHUs, which means containerized housing units. Our northern base of operations from the city of Erbil. This is looking down. It has an ancient old walled portion in the center of the city that is purported to be the oldest continuously occupied city in the world, going back 6,000 years. Again, this is sort of the capital of the autonomous region of the Kurdistan region of northern Iraq. This is where the Kurdistan regional government sits. Roads out to Sulaymaniyah, road to Kirkuk, road out to Mosul. There's Hammurabi sort of greeting you at the gate of this ancient walled city. And to contrast though with Baghdad, it's a modern, bustling city where one can move around freely, one can take taxis, one can walk through the markets, and it's very, very different. It's a completely different world than what you find in Baghdad. You wouldn't think you're in the same country. Now, moving on to the science activities of the project, we were focused on evaluating non-fuel mineral resources, water resources, establishing an agro-meteorological network, developing an Iraq national SPADA data infrastructure, and also evaluating the analytical laboratories of the Geological Survey of Iraq. Just for some orientation purposes, Iraq is made up of 18 different provinces, four different geographic regions, if you will, the Mesopotamian plain where the Tigris and Euphrates converge, the southern desert, the western desert, and then this, the northern mountainous region, which is the autonomous Kurdistan region. Moving on one by one through the various science activities, non-fuel mineral resources. It was involved about four different tasks, updating the geologic and mineral deposit information, reprocessing existing geophysical data, using ASTER satellite imagery, and also helping the Iraqi Geological Survey and regional geochemical surveys. Most of our mineral investigations were concentrated in the western desert Anbar region of western Iraq, but also in the Kurdistan region of northern Iraq. Within the western desert region, there are known world-class phosphate resources, but we actually focused on the possibility of large lead-zinc resources that they had not looked at before, but that we felt was a real possibility based on work that we had done years ago in Saudi Arabia in the same package of rocks. These are carbonate-hosted lead-zinc deposits. They often are associated with regional dolomitization, so we used ASTER to map out calcite and dolomite occurrences, and we're looking for calcite-dolomite fronts that then we used to follow up with some regional geochemistry and on-the-ground surveys that our Iraqi colleagues are currently carrying on with as we speak. With regards to the Kurdistan region, this is where most of the metallic deposits in Iraq are located, and unfortunately most of them are hugging the Iranian border, so it's a bit of a challenge to get in there. One of the more important outcomes of this work was taking 70s vintage aerogeophysical data, aeromagnetic data, and aeroradiometric data, and actually being able to recover it and reprocess it into new digital databases using state-of-the-art digital processing techniques. And so that is now just about to be released, and clearly it has numerous applications beyond mineral assessment or mineral exploration. With regards to our water resource work, concentrated mostly on surface water, groundwater resource assessments, as well as what we call a transboundary flow assessment. And the surface water assessment was mainly to help in their renovation of their satellite telemetry network of stream gauges, water quality stations, and snow monitoring stations. The surface water resources of Iraq are dwindling, and so consequently they were really looking for help in trying to understand and appreciate what their groundwater resources might be. So in doing that, we helped them construct a series of hydrogeologic cross-sections through various basins throughout the country. This one in particular is in the Sulaymaniyah Basin up here in the northeast part of Iraq near the Iranian border. Within this basin is what has recently become a rather infamous spring, Zum Spring. This is the last location that our three hikers had visited before they strayed over into the Iranian border. Throughout our water resource work, we've done a tremendous amount of capacity building, whether it's training on water quality monitoring or advanced Doppler velocity meter training for stream gauging. Our transboundary flow assessment is involved with looking at what's coming across the border in both the Tigris and Euphrates and comparing it to what could be coming across the border. And so we've been working with the Iraqis and helping them understand how to develop ways of looking at water content of snowpack, primarily in Turkey and other places where the waters of the Tigris and Euphrates are originating. And so getting an understanding of the water content, what should be coming over the border versus what is coming over the border, and using that in negotiations with their Syrian and Turkish neighbors in regional water resource negotiations. So basically this is an area where science is truly being used in negotiations, and you could argue one form of science diplomacy. The establishment of an agrometeorological network for Iraq has involved the purchase and installation of what ultimately will be about 100 of these agromet stations throughout the country in all 18 provinces. These are used for crop yield forecasting for the most part, but they consist of rain gauges, instrumentation for various kinds of meteorological information, as well as instrumentation for dust monitoring. And so this is an example of one group of Iraqis that we have trained in the installation of the first three stations, and they are going about themselves installing the rest throughout the country. And I should mention, I meant to mention earlier, that probably one of the most important outcomes of this work with regard to science diplomacy has been our ability to bring the Kurds and the Arabs together in Iraq in the spirit of scientific cooperation. And this is one example where clearly water is important to both, and where they have come together and we have helped bring them together in this particular effort. With regards to our Iraq National Spatial Data Infrastructure activity, this is involved in basically coordinating and standardizing all spatial data in the country. And what we're starting with in an existing situation like this, where each ministry or agency has their own data and holds that data, doesn't necessarily share it with anyone, And we're trying to get to a situation like this where all ministries, all agencies with important spatial data information feeds it into a central node. And they do not lose ownership of the data, because that is a huge issue. But it provides access to that data that potential investors in whatever sector of the country could come and access any type of spatial data that might be of use. And so what this has entailed, first and foremost, is creating a stakeholder community of spatial data holders within the country. And this is a list of the ministries now we have on board. Ministries, again, both from the government of Iraq, the central government in Baghdad, as well as participation from the Kurdistan regional government up in Kurdistan. And then finally, we sent a team to evaluate the analytical laboratories of the Geological Survey of Iraq. They have come forth with recommendations on renovation, instrument upgrade, and purchases, and so forth, to bring them up to a sort of a national geological survey level. We've also helped them in developing a laboratory information management system that brings together the different types of analyses from the various different laboratories and pulls it all in one place. And one of the things they asked us first and foremost when we went there was, you know, they had just purchased some new instrumentation, in this case a new XRF instrument, and what they desperately needed was reference materials for calibration, which we could quite easily help them with because we actually create a lot of these materials ourselves. And so that we were able to help them with as well. Moving on now to Afghanistan. This is a geologic and mineral resource map of Afghanistan that we created back in 2000. It was released back in 2006. This came out of what we call phase one of our activities in Afghanistan, which occurred from 2004 to 2007. This work was supported by USAID and also by the government of Afghanistan. We had several fields of work. We conducted and completed a countrywide non-fuel mineral resource assessment, a petroleum resource assessment of the Afghan Tajik, the Helmand, and the Khatawaz Basin, basically these areas shown here in yellow. We did a water resource assessment of the Kabul Basin and other selected regions of the country. We also did a countrywide earthquake hazard assessment. And we flew airborne geophysical and hyperspectral surveys countrywide. These are some examples of some of the products that came out of that phase one work. Again, the geologic mineral resource map, water resource assessment of the Kabul Basin. We've also released a couple of 100,000 scale geologic maps, particularly in the Kabul area, with new information, both derived from satellite imagery as well as from on the ground observations. And we published our airborne geophysical. In this case, the aeromagnetic data. The hypospectral survey that we flew was, again, also countrywide and is truly a unique database, unique perhaps anywhere in the world. We don't even have this sort of information in our own country. And we're now beginning to put it to use in some of the work we're doing as we speak in Afghanistan. Throughout all of this work, we were involved in various types of field investigations and training of geologists with the Afghan Geological Survey. So currently what we had noticed phase two of our work in Afghanistan last year and currently this through 2011. One of the more important outcomes of our phase one activities was our non-fuel mineral resource assessment. And from that we identified many target areas throughout the country that we felt were deserving of follow-up work. And they're shown here in these rectangular boxes. And so the work that we're currently doing in the country is once again funded by this task force that recently funded our work in Iraq. And in 2010 and last year, we prioritized these target areas for work, and those are the ones shown in the red circles. And what we're doing in each one of these circular target areas now is we are... We're focusing on gathering information that would be helpful in developing the potential of these areas, the mental potential of these areas. The work is multidisciplinary. The type of data that we're compiling is multidisciplinary, hydrogeologic data, geophysical data. We're processing the hyperspectral data that was flown during phase one for each one of these target areas. We're collecting new geochemical samples, and we're doing a resource analysis from the data that we have to work with. And again, through this work, we're engaging more now than in phase one, the actual Afghan Geological Survey folks, because of the training that we were able to provide them during phase one. So here they are, trenching for gold in the Badakhshan region of the north, sampling for copper in the Volkhov Copper District here in western Afghanistan. The objective and ultimate products of this work in Afghanistan is a compilation and creation of these data and information packages for each of these target areas to help promote interest and investment and development of the mineral resources in them. This is just an example of some of the types of data that we're pulling together in each one of these packages, high-resolution DEM data, quick bird and Iconos images or imagery, again, the hyperspectral data, which is an example of which is shown down here where we've draped hyperspectral data over shaded relief from the DEM, and here we're actually able to map individual minerals and mineral assemblages. We're also pulling together the previous geophysical data from phase one activities. We also will be flying some new airborne geophysical surveys over some of these target areas this year. We're also continuing to collect data from scoping missions in the field. This is an example of working together with the Afghan Geological Survey and sampling the Khanishin Uranium Rare Earth District in southern Afghanistan. Data that the Afghan Geological Survey has been compiling themselves in their ongoing work, as well as data from archival compilations, a lot of which is from Soviet work from the 70s and 80s. Challenges, issues, and lessons learned. There are many, 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 of course, and I've just listed three here as examples. What we're finding in as we've conducted these projects is that there are really two customers. One is the funding agency, and one is those who truly benefit from our work on the ground, the government agencies and so forth in the host countries. And sometimes the desires and needs of both are not in sync. For example, one might want simply deliverable products, while the other might want training and capacity building of their people. So understanding that from the very beginning, I think, is important in terms of project planning, staffing, and budgeting. Negotiations with both sides is important to do as you go forward. And I think if you have the luxury of time, which you often don't have in these situations, it's easily to overcome. But if you see there are conflicting needs, then you simply staff and budget accordingly from the very beginning. Communicating the importance of making data and information available to the public domain has been a real challenge, particularly in Iraq, coming from an autocratic or formerly autocratic sort of system where they wanted to keep things close hold. But with numerous discussions showing the benefits of releasing this information in the public domain and how that can truly attract interest and development in their industries is something that we've had success with perseverance, but it does take some work. And then finally, as you might imagine, doing field work in these areas is truly a challenge. The picture at top is what it took to take one USGS geologist to get to visit some mineral localities along the Iranian border region of the Kurdistan region of northern Iraq. The people in blue shirts are what they call the Peshmerga or the Kurdish army, and the folks in the khaki are actually with the private security detail that takes us around the field. The photograph on the bottom is what it took to take three USGS geologists into the field in Afghanistan. It's very cumbersome, of course, not terribly efficient, but unfortunately it goes with the territory here. However, it also can be extremely awkward when working with your local Iraqi or Afghan counterparts, because these people are here to protect us, not to protect them. And it becomes a very, very, in some cases, difficult and I would consider almost humiliating situation you find yourself in. My hope is that the work that we're doing now will allow us to come back and work with our colleagues in some future years and not be able to have to deal with this. And so finally, one of the things I think we've learned through this process is that science diplomacy is really important to practice at all levels. With fellow scientists, whether it's in the classroom or in the field, and again, I think our biggest science diplomacy success, particularly in Iraq, was the ability in this case to bring the Kurds and the Arabs together, working for a common goal and putting their differences apart. But also it's important to practice it with the government leaders. In this case, it was with a Kurdish regional government minister. In this case, it was meeting with a village elder in the mountains of Afghanistan. In both cases, it's important to try to communicate the science that you're doing in their language and trying to help them understand how it will benefit them and their people and ultimately give guys like this a fighting chance in the future. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Jeff. We have time for one question from the back. If you'd come up and identify yourself, please. And we are running a little bit behind, so we've decided to forego the interim Q&A, and we're going to move on to our fourth speaker. But the question first?
I'm Joan Dudikayoso. I'm from GW, but I'm also a longtime USAID former employee. I just was wondering if you could talk in Afghanistan a little bit about the ownership of the resources that you're mapping. In many developing countries, the issue isn't just what resources are available, but how they're exploited and who gets to benefit. And maybe too early to answer that question, but whatever is going on that you can share would be useful. Sure. Thank you.
Sure. I mean, clearly ownership of us is with the host government. Unfortunately, there isn't. The host government in Afghanistan doesn't go much beyond Kabul. So that's truly a challenge. There was recently a tender bid process for a very large copper deposit outside of Kabul that was ultimately awarded to a Chinese company. And there are others in line to be tendered very soon. And we hope that in those processes that there will be a bit more transparency involved. That's an issue. That's truly an issue in countries like this. All we can do is do our best in using the science that we have to at least make it known what resources that they do have in their country and hope that they can and with help we can provide in other ways to make it available for the better of their whole country.
Were the land resources government land?
Yes.
Or tribal land?
Yes.
Thank you very much, Jeff. We're going to move to our fourth speaker. Our fourth speaker is Dr. Pedro Sanchez. Pedro is the director of the Tropical Agricultural and Rural Environmental Program and director of the Millennium Villages Project at the Earth Institute at Columbia University. Pedro is a graduate of Cornell University. He's a fellow of the AAAS and in 2002 was a World Food Prize laureate and a 2004 MacArthur Fellow. So,
thank you, Tom. I want to share things today in terms of lessons learned and going into another discipline. So I start with my summary, where my forays into policy have been successful. They all have a similar trend. I either led or was part of a multidisciplinary team, never of a just a soil science team. Policymakers requested evidence-based solution to a problem, so you're responding to a felt request. It has to be done, and it was done in partnership with local institutions, whether research or extension services in our case. And government donors or, quote, game changers realize that the issue at hand, let's say soil fertility, was the entry point, and that this would be followed by a wider range of disciplines and institutions. So there's four things. Multidisciplinary team. The request came from the government or other authorities, partnership, and the issue being an entry point. Now, my forays were unsuccessful when the ideas, the concepts arose only out of scientific curiosity and did not form part of the policymakers' or the farmers' agenda at that time, and when I did not work as a team. However, in defense of the latter, such initiatives contributed to science and graduate education. They ended up creating research networks of young soil scientists in Latin America and later in Africa, and they changed paradigms in tropical soil science, but they did not influence policy. Some initiatives, again, all this is retrospect, but some initiatives take many years to incubate and get buy-in. The alternatives to slash and burn agriculture issue, which is key to tropical deforestation and so on. The research started in the Amazon of Peru in 1972, but it became a system-wide program of the CGIAR, the Consultative Group of International Agricultural Research, the International Ag Centers, almost 20 years later. Luckily, that continues. The CGIAR Intercenter Working Group on Climate Change, which was proposed in 2001, at that time I was head of the Center Directors Group and proposed this, and all the centers had a person there, and we were very excited about let's get international agriculture into climate change. It was totally not accepted at all by the donors. And now, in 2011, it is a so-called mega program of the CGIAR. It took 10 years to get climate change across to the international agronomy, international agricultural community. Soil fertility depletion in Africa actually didn't start in 1995, started in 1975 by Dutch soil scientists. It came to a head in 1995 or so, and was finally implemented in 2005. So why all these delays? Because of multiple partners, complex interactions, complex negotiations, and persistency. But some of the things did not jump automatically. That's what I'm trying to say. But some successful episodes, based on the very clear policymakers' needs, did go successful, and I'd like to talk a little bit about my first one right after finishing a PhD, rice production in Peru, then the Cerrado region of Brazil, then the elimination of bulldozer land clearing. The work was done in Amazon tropical forest, but it was implemented in Indonesia, and then 10-year rights for complex agroforesters in Sumatra in Indonesia. My first foray was actually almost a dream. The government was committed in increasing rice production and getting out of importing rice, the third most important thing in Peru. I never heard of a donor. Everything was financed by the Minister of Agriculture of Peru and my portion with North Carolina State University. And we had the technology coming in from the Green Revolution in Asia, which was changing from from these tall, old varieties, very productive, but they're tall like that, and then they fall down to the new so-called miracle rice varieties that came out of the Philippines, adapted to Latin American condition. It was very, very quick. It wasn't easy, but it was very, very quick. Then I was asked to come to Brazil to talk about the Cerrado region, which is this interior savanna of about 200 million hectares in the middle of the country, which is now famous for being competitive with the U.S. Midwest. The head of research in Brazil at that time, Roberto Meireles de Miranda, asked me, can this desert be productive? I said, well, sir, first, it's not a desert. It's 1,500 millimeters of rain here. It's just that the soils are very, very low in soil fertility and very acid. So he said, okay, prove it. So I was able, I was able to be engaged in a joint design with EMBRAPA, which is a national research institution, create the Cerrado Research Center, and work on issues such as soil fertility. What you see in the back and here, dead maize plants, is the ones that didn't receive any phosphorus. This is a border row, and this is what happens when you put some soil fertility into it. This was done with Cornell and NC State graduate students and Brazilian scientists. Some of them, it went very fast. Within about 10 years, it became an ocean of soybeans, which is competing, having similar yields to those of the United States, and is competing actually very favorable with the United States in the savanna regions. I'm not talking about the Amazon of Brazil. I felt that students like this one here, Alfredo Lopez, former students, then became chancellor of a university there, that our team had to get out of the way, our American team had to get out of the way to enable the Brazilians to fully own and take it over, and they sure did, and they sure did. It's one of the shining examples, the largest increase in agricultural land in the last half of the last century, and it's not without problems, but it's been a real example on what tropical soils can do. Bulldozer clearing, I don't even have a slide of that because this is now just totally past tense. The disadvantage of clearing a secondary forest or even a primary forest with bulldozers over the traditional slash and burn method was found in Peru, in Yurima. It was published in 1995. And nothing much happened about that until USAID sent us to Indonesia. And there, Dr. Muljadi, who was director of the Crops Research Institute, says, we have this problem. We're having all these transmigration areas, and they're clearing by bulldozers and decapitating the soil, pulling all the topsoil away and so on. So we quickly translated this article in Bahasa Indonesia, and then he said, now we know we're not alone. They thought this was their own unique problem. And now we know they're all alone. The policy was rapidly applied, and it's nobody talks about this anymore. Another case in Indonesia, when I was at the World Agroforestry Center, was the fact that inside the supposedly forest land, there are these local people, similar to the ones that Julie were mentioning, who actually developed very sustainable and very productive and very profitable complex agroforestry systems in government forest land. This is one of the trees that they use, Damar, as a source of resins. But anyway, these people with a bunch of agroforests that they designed, there was no science involved here. They were doing very well, but they were encroaching, or they were supposed to be encroached in government lands. So what do you do about it? The Minister of Forestry called us in 1994 saying, can you help us? It's politically very, very sensitive. There are a lot of interests there. And I said, sure, sir. We'll put a couple of economists in your ministry and work with you and work especially with the local people to try to get a solution. Working with local NGOs and local people, the solution came out as tree tenure. Land tenure was just too tricky, just too politically sensitive to grant to these people. But they could own the trees, and their children can own the trees, and any trees they planted. So it was, in effect, land tenure. This was my economist's colleagues were in the lead there. Certainly was not a soil science issue. The big one that I want to talk to you about is soil fertility depletion in Africa. As I mentioned before, the scientific evidence was there in 1975. Nobody paid any attention, but it sort of mounted in the 1990s. And myself, as a newcomer to Africa, I looked at it, I saw it right away, but I kept my mouth shut for about 4 years, saying, look, Sanchez, this is your discipline, you're biased. you better make sure if you say something. And after 4 or 5 years, I couldn't keep my mouth shut and started screaming about this. then enters our period at Columbia University, and with Jeffrey Sachs as director of the Earth Institute, who says, I don't know anything about agriculture, but I think it's very important. So he asked my wife, Cheryl Palm, here, and me to join him. And one of the first things that he did was a UN Millennium Project requested by the Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, to make all these Millennium Development Goals happen, that all the countries in the world sign, including ours, in the year 2000, and nothing was happening. Can you put some specifics into this? So I was able to co-chair the Hunger Task Force with Professor Swaminathan from India, and while we were defining things and traveling all over the place, we were able to convince then Secretary General Kofi Annan to launch and make this a plea for help, even before the report was published in 1995. Kofi Annan said right there on July 5th, 2004, at a side event of the African Union governments, was that he wanted a 21st century African Green Revolution and made a call for that. Africa was left behind with yields of about a ton per hectare of cereals, while already Latin America, Southeast Asia were at 3, China at 5, and the U.S. and Europe 10. We worked together, Jeff and I, with the Secretary General, and in the speech and so on. At one point he asked me, have you seen the speech? And I said, well, I wrote most of it, sir, so yes, I've seen it. And what he presented, basically all the scientists' ideas as his own ideas in this speech. Since then, there's been a lot of follow-up. And one of them is that realizing that we have to work at different scales within a country, local, national, and global scales. So going from the farmer who's now is moving to be some sort of a tailor to the president of Mali, to a group of people, highly influential donors and ministers, to make this thing happen. One of the things we started was Millennium Villages, which asked the questions, how about if poor villagers in hunger hotspots, which are also poverty and disease hotspots of sub-Saharan Africa, are empowered one way or another one to accomplish all the Millennium Development Goals by 2015. So we got the setup of a network of 14 sites in different agricultural zones where poverty is a total of 80 villages, each of about 5,000 people each. The basic of this thing is that the community leads. The questions were asked, what are your greatest needs in these villages? And most of the villages, they said, we need agricultural inputs, meaning fertilizers, and improved varieties. And we need a clinic. I'm only going to talk about the agricultural side in this presentation. But it was based on science, like an experiment in Malawi on agroforestry that showed very good responses and so on. But it was based on what the people felt, the combination of the two. Also, we had to get the buy-in from the very, very top. And indeed, we got the buy-in from the presidents of all these countries, or prime ministers. And what you see there is some nice visits to presidential palaces in Ghana and Kenya. So they were involved, and they actually used the villages to foster their own policies, because you could see things there. It's not a piece of paper or a project. And indeed, if you recall, this old figure, how the crops used to look like. Now, with just what the villagers wanted and the science behind it, yields just went through the roof. 5 tons per hectare, about half of what we get in the United States, and the average has been closer to 4. But what we fear, so what was a real degraded agricultural landscape, all of a sudden you look at this. And this was all done by the farmers, of course. We calculated that over all the villages, it cost about $135 in 2008 to grow an extra ton of maize in terms of fertilizers, in terms of seeds, and in terms of extension. And Bruce, this is a farm that you visited, and you didn't see it that way. But that's where I had the honor of hosting Bruce in 1997. Then we began started comparing with that hard data. It costs $135 to produce an extra ton of food. Now, how much does it cost in terms of food aid delivered from the United States? The answer was about $112 when this was taken. In other words, if you use, if you do the old Chinese proverb of give people food and they'll eat for a day, give people a fish, it'll cost you about 10 times as much as empower people how to fish and they will eat for a lifetime. This was published in Nature and may have contributed to some of the changes, positive changes in the Obama administration in this sense. I'm not sure. That's part of the policy thing. You never know for sure. But things have changed. Malawi became the first country to really take the African Green Revolution, to embrace it the way Kofi Annan wanted. There's nothing special about Malawi. It's a very impoverished country. It's landlocked. It's full of bad roads. It's full of corruption. Yields were low. Yeah. But this person, the president, told us, I didn't get elected to be a beggar. 45% of my people are being fed by food aid. What should I do? And says, well, sir, subsidize fertilizers and hybrid maize seed. He did it. The year before this started, it was a deficit, horrible deficit of 43%. The year after the subsidy started, went to a surplus. Even in 2007 was such a surplus that Malawi became a food exporter and also a food aid donor to its neighbors. And in and out in the last few years, up and down, it's been very positive. The interesting thing was this last year just completed, April 2008, which was a drought year, and still production was high, and the yields were comparable because what they had more than a water drought was a nitrogen drought. This, then, is a scaling up, meetings like in Bellagio with future leaders, including the administrator of USAID when he was in a previous position, trying to raise this issue more. And finally, at the worldwide level, a global program for agricultural and food security was launched, but with low funding. Low funding, which is a problem. In conclusion, I would say that what helped was that clarity of goals, persistence. Some of these things take a long time to hatch. Very important to mentor teams of young scientists, engage a range of stakeholders from farmers to government leaders, forget about attribution. The hero of the Malawi Green Revolution is certainly the president of Malawi, the political will that he showed there, and knowing when to step aside and let people in the country really take on the reins. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Pedro. We have time for a question for Dr. Sanchez. Thank you. In the interest of time, we're going to move to our last speaker, and then we'll have comments by our discussant, Dr. Bruce Alberts, and a Q&A. But thank you very much, John.
Sure.
Our final speaker is Jonathan Overpeck from the University of Arizona. Jonathan prefers to be called Peck, and I'm looking for your slides there, Peck, and I got them. Jonathan's degrees are from the University of Brown University, his doctorate, before coming to the University of Arizona, where he's currently a professor of geosciences and a professor of atmospheric Sciences. He was a founding director of the NOAA Paleoclimatology Program and also the World Data Center for Paleoclimatology in Boulder, Colorado. So welcome, Peck.
Thank you, and thank you all for sticking with us this long. This is not going to be a story of early warning, unfortunately. We've known for decades that climate change is coming. We've known with increasing confidence that it's going to be very substantial, and it's going to wreak havoc not just on human systems but on natural systems. And you can see what that has resulted in from the world's governments. Maybe we need a small precursor cloud or two. And in fact, I was thinking when you mentioned that little cloud is probably what hurricanes and droughts and other food crises do to maybe get climate more on the radar screen. What I want to do today, though, is talk more about what the IPCC is in the context of international science diplomacy and international political diplomacy, and those two things are interconnected, obviously, as we've heard today. But they are also quite separate and important for this kind of an enterprise. There's a lot of misunderstanding about the IPCC, and I think if there's nothing more important in my talk, it's to walk away realizing that IPCC works, and it works well, and I hope to convince you of that. I'm just going to talk about the rise of use-inspired science. I think that's been the theme of this whole session. But it's something that really has transitioned back in the 90s in my own field, climate science, as I was emerging from grad school. And we're going to do a quick overview of the IPCC, talk about the evidence that it works, and then talk a little more about this role of diplomacy in the IPCC and vice versa. Okay. First, a really important disclaimer. When I agreed to give this talk, I said, oh, yeah, I think that would be a very interesting thing to do. And then I immediately got off the email, and I said, holy cow, I'm not supposed to do this. The IPCC is an intergovernmental organization, and scientists work for the governments of the world in this process. And I don't speak for the IPCC in any way, shape, or form. I'm just a scientist who's been involved at various levels over the years in the IPCC process, all the way from a really almost precursory or small effort in a level of involvement all the way up to in the last assessment being one of the leaders of the Working Group 1 effort working for Susan Solomon and Shinda He. Okay, I was a coordinating lead author there. So now I'm free to say whatever I want. Back in the day when we all got into this in climate scientists, and I know there are a couple other climate scientists in the room, I think we were sucked into this for the curiosity, the fact that working on climate science was very interesting, understanding part of our natural environment. And we could work, and it was cool to see Connie Woodhouse here because this is from one of her papers. We were interested in drought for the sake of drought. And I know in that time we were probably thinking, well, drought's important because these things happen and we want to understand why. But it was kind of that transitioning into something a little more serious that occurred a couple decades ago. The realization came in our field. I think the thing that really was the tipping point, the realization came that there's predictability in the climate system, not just weather forecasts, but we could actually make predictions, seasonal predictions in climate. We could, thanks to the knowledge of El Nino, La Nina, the Southern Oscillation that came out in the 1990s, we could start to say months and almost a year in advance what's going to happen to certain key parts of the climate system, key parts of the world, including the United States. And that became pretty exciting. All of a sudden we're saying, gosh, people could use this information. We started to work with decision makers and stakeholders, and the demand started to grow for this. As we were doing that, quickly learned, as did the decision makers we were partnering with, that there's climate variability that people are interested in. There's also climate change. And it really is the rise of kind of the awareness of climate change isn't just because of scientists going around saying it's happening, it's happening, it's happening, it's going to get worse, it's going to get worse, it's going to get worse. It's because we've engaged with stakeholders on the climate variability issue, and these very same people developed an understanding and a trust in the climate science community, and they've started to ask questions whose answers reveal climate change. And they start to ask questions that require us doing different science. All right. They're interested in both natural variability and human-caused climate change. And the other thing that's occurred is, of course, that the challenges of climate change, as well as the benefits, because it's not all bad stuff. There's good stuff in having knowledge in advance to be able to improve economic well-being of people, to protect what we value, to make money. It's not all bad, although it is probably mostly bad. But it's been recognized as global, all right? And when that happened, it quickly started to emerge that climate change is, by definition, going to have to be a diplomatic endeavor, all right? And that there's a real urgency developing to understand what's going on, because it's becoming clear that we are, as we put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, CO2, methane, and other greenhouse gases, that we are not only causing climate change, but we're essentially buying into future climate change. And in some cases, this change, in many cases, is going to be irreversible on human timescales. So this urgency is starting to pick up with those who pay attention and understand what's going on, that we have to figure out how to act and in what ways. And it's the role of the scientists to provide the scientific understanding and not to prescribe what to do. Okay. So a good example of this, and this is so I could use my nifty new AAAS laser pointer that they gave all the speakers. And this just came out in a last issue of Science on an issue about data, a special section about data, which I encourage you to read if you want to find out about some of the squeaky wheels in climate science. But the big thing here is that climate has been slowly warming, and you can see it isn't every year, but it's going inexorably. The Earth is getting warmer. There's a temperature axis here. And these two globes are simulated globes by one of the premier climate models of the United States, the NCAR, National Center for Atmospheric, latest global climate model. And you can see the Earth has warmed, not everywhere in a given year, but it is warming more and more. And we're headed on some trajectory out beyond this year into the future. And we have a lot of choice in what that trajectory is. We can just let the greenhouse gases accumulate, pedal to the metal, business as usual, whatever you want to say, and we can get a lot of warming, and we can get an Earth that looks much redder, much hotter in the future, or we can decide to curb our emissions at a moderate level or at a low level. That choice is ours, but it's really important for science to work out how these emissions of greenhouse gases translate into these temperature trajectories, and then how does that translate to effects on water resources, oceans, fisheries, agriculture, biodiversity, energy, land use. You get the picture. Just about everything we care about is going to be affected by climate change. And the international science is needed to figure these things out because, lo and behold, the problem is intrinsically international. It requires diplomacy, not just to figure out solutions, but to figure out what is really happening to the system, why, and can we project into the future time series or scenarios of what's going to happen. We need international cooperation to collect observations of the Earth system. We need international cooperation to get research and understanding, and these big climate models. This happens to be one of the U.S. Premier models in addition to a couple others, but this is an international enterprise, and it's sharing of the data, sharing of all these results that gives us the knowledge we need to inform decision-making, both at the international down to local scale, because a lot of what we're going to end up doing, no doubt, as we do nothing about these emissions, is we're going to be adapting to climate change. And adaptation occurs often at a scale of a watershed or a ranch or a farm. Okay. So the birth of the IPCC. This is to tell us a little about the IPCC for those who don't know much about it. It was definitely born of diplomacy. It was born when the World Meteorological Organization and the UN Environment Program formed this back in 19, 88. And the whole goal was to provide the governments, it's an intergovernmental operation here, the governments of the world with a clear scientific view of what is happening to the world's climate, why, and how. What does it say about the future? And we, the IPCC, I'm not going to say we because I wasn't involved at this point. I was just coming out of grad school back then. But they produced the first report back in 1990. So it's not that old. And we always hear about the treaties that didn't happen of late on climate change, but there has actually been quite a bit of agreement internationally on climate change. There was Kyoto, we've all heard about that, but before that was the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change that was signed at the Earth Summit in Rio in 1992, informed by that 1990 report of the IPCC. At that time, scientists of the world working together said, hey, the climate is changing. Humans are probably causing this change, and a whole bunch of other stuff is going to happen. Pay attention. And so the 186 nations of the world, that's a fairly large number, right, agreed to this Framework Convention on Climate Change. The U.S. signed it and ratified it. And in there, there are a whole bunch of things, but one is the sort of this ultimate objective, which is to prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. Well, what is dangerous? They define that, too, as something that allows ecosystems, we want to not go beyond the point where ecosystems can adapt naturally, that we can ensure that food production is not threatened by climate, and we can enable economic development to proceed in a sustainable manner. So the nations, even back in the 90s, were very interested in figuring out where the tipping point, let's say, is between some climate change that we can adapt to and a whole pile of climate change that could be quite difficult to adapt to. And that's why the IPCC exists, in a sense. All right? I love to throw in science to these talks because otherwise I have trouble. So you probably do, too. So this just came out, one of my graduate students. And I think it just highlights sort of how big this problem can be. Because as we warm this Earth, what's happening? The Earth is the oceans are expanding. They're warming. They're expanding like a hot air balloon. That's rising sea level. Right now, that's dominating the 3 millimeters per year sea level rise that we get. But increasingly, the big ice sheets, you know, there are glaciers and other things going on, but the big ice sheets, the polar ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica are starting to lose mass in an increasingly rapid fashion. We now know that from satellite measurements. And the loss of mass seems to be pretty clear. Well, that's going to raise sea level. And what's going to happen to the Earth? The debate always seems to be fixated on what's going to happen by 2100. What people forget is, well, at some point the Earth will probably be warm enough, perhaps as early as mid-century, to melt the ice sheets. And, of course, the big question is how fast do ice sheets melt? And it's pretty slow on human timescales, but it's quite fast on geologic timescales. And I'm going to predict that when the next report of the IPCC comes out, we'll be saying 1 meter per century is possible. And so what Jeremy did in this work is he looked at 180 U.S. municipalities on the coast that are larger than 50,000 people, and he just mapped out using GIS how much of those municipalities would be flooded for given levels of sea level rise. We could have one sea level meter by the end of this century, and give us a few more centuries, we could warm the Earth enough in this century to get well beyond 1 meter of sea level, up to, you know, in this case we mapped up to 6 in coming centuries. And some cities like New Orleans, 90% of that municipality will be flooded with 1 meter of sea level rise. Other cities like Los Angeles won't see that big effect. But on average, you can see for the 180 municipalities along the U.S. coastlines, 10% of the area of those municipalities will be submerged with 1 meter, and eventually much more substantial parts of the U.S. Coastal infrastructure will be submerged. All right? Of course, this is a global problem. You know, you can imagine being in Bangkok or in Bangladesh. This is with 6 meters of sea level equivalent. These are huge effects. And a lot of the largest megacities of the world are in not ideal situations. Here's this hurricane that or tropical cyclone. See how it's going the wrong way for those of us in this hemisphere? But this is the one that just hit Australia. We're getting more of these Category 5 storms, and scientists are not in agreement as to whether we're seeing a statistically significant increase in the large hurricanes yet, but they are in agreement that we will see it. Okay? There are other things that are really important to us, and I'll get back to the diplomacy, but you just got to see what's at stake here. This paper just came out in Science as well, and it shows the most recent compilation of how the Earth's biota, plants and animals, could be affected by climate change. In the past, extinction rates were relatively small in terms of extinctions per million years on this scale. But in the 20th century and now projected for the 21st century, extinction rates of 50%, up to 50% per century of species, plants and animals on Earth. And the good news is that the range is also includes lower numbers, but we really don't know yet. The stakes are pretty darn high, whether you care about coastal cities or you care about natural systems and biodiversity. Okay. So what is the IPCC? I've already talked a little about that, but this is what's really important when it comes to diplomacy. The IPCC is a scientific body, and it's literally thousands of scientists from around the world working together. It's really quite neat listening to the analogous efforts that have gone on in these other areas of science. And it makes me feel like, wow, climate science is actually pretty advanced and doing pretty well, and it's only ironic that we're having less impact than you guys are. It's a process that strives to be comprehensive, objective, open, and transparent. I'll show you the next slide. I'll just go there now and come back. You can go on the web and see the way the system works. There's nothing mysterious or behind the curtain here, even though in the blogs they love to say that. Okay? And the whole goal is to assess the most recent literature, mostly peer-reviewed literature. And if you follow where the IPCC has tripped up, it's in the use of non-peer-reviewed literature, which often is pretty critical because a lot of governments, particularly if you're looking at regional scale change and around the world, the information is in government documents and in other sources other than our normal peer-reviewed literature. We have to assess everything, but we have to be very careful when we use non-peer-reviewed literature. If the IPCC doesn't do any research, it's assessing the literature. It's reviewing the literature. And it's not policy prescriptive. That's very key that we don't prescribe what to do. It's to provide understanding and choices for action. And that's often misinterpreted as well. Okay. Now, the evidence of the IPCC works. All right? The governments of the world are very engaged. So I was in a plenary at the last assessment. We released the 2007 Fourth Assessment Report of the Working Group 1 in the UNESCO building in Paris. There were over 100 nations. Their diplomats were in the room with, you know, a few of us scientists approving the final report. They approved the process. It's a very iterative process. They approved the process. They approved the foci of the reports. They approved the outlines and the structures. They review the thing. They approve it in the end. If it's not approved by the nations, that would be a sign that maybe they didn't like it. They approve it. All right? There's a lot of negotiation going on to make sure that we've communicated the science well, but they're interested less in the nature of the science and more how are we communicating so they can use it. The results are widely used, way beyond the purpose of the IPCC, for almost all climate change adaptation mitigation discussions today. Scientists volunteer their time. They don't do it just once. They do it over and over. And as someone who led one of the chapters, you know, it's very much like when you're finishing your thesis, for those of you who did that. It's an enormous amount of work. And yet we come back and we want to do it again. It's not just because we're crazy. It's because this is something that works. This is something that we get really positive feedback from the governments. All right? And when problems of the system, problem with the IPCC emerge, and they do every single cycle, and you remember Amazon Gate, Glacier Gate, and all these gates. I get kind of tired of these gates. You know, the problems are quickly fixed, not just filling in the knowledge that was missing, but also evolving the process so that those problems hopefully won't emerge, similar problems, in the future. Okay, and the IPCC has a tradition of doing that. It's not to say it's perfect, but it says it really learns from its problems and mistakes. Okay, so what about IPCC and science diplomacy? All right. I think there are two things. I'm going to say this as a scientist. Diplomacy is critical, and the IPCC has done amazing things to advance our science. All right. It's required that we study the problem from a global perspective, all right? And it's required that we tap expertise from multiple countries. It just can't be done without all the expertise from around the world. And there are lots of reasons for that, but one is data. One is local understanding. And the IPCC is what has been leading, among a lot of other really good organizations, international organizations, has been leading the capacity building for us all, scientists who study climate from around the world, to work together as equals. And it really is having, that perhaps is the coolest thing about being involved in the process, is the friendships and the collaborations and the understanding across all sorts of political, ideological, cultural spectra, all right? You know, including scientists with nations that the United States is not supposed to talk to and all that crap. All right? The point is, as scientists working together, we're working together because we have to solve a problem that this world needs to figure out. All right? And so how does the IPCC do this? It of course, requires diversity of authorship from around the world. It provides funding for participation from those countries, from scientists from countries who can't afford it. The U.S. has to pay for their scientists to participate. Rich countries do it that way. But we have a fund for scientists from developing countries. We have other special programs. When we won the Nobel Prize, what do we use the money for? That money was used for a scholarship for young scientists from developing countries, okay, to become involved in climate research. So that's the education scholarships. We also provide library access for those who need it to be involved as an equal in this assessment process. And it's just this philosophy that we're all in this together, and no scientist is better because they're from a more wealthy country or something. Okay, the IPCC is also important from a political diplomacy. You know, I'm not someone who studies quote-unquote soft power and things like that, but it's really clear that a number of countries have a real reason to support this process beyond just trying to figure out what the science is, all right? Because in order to solve this problem, if we really are going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, it's a global problem, and countries of the world don't like being told what to do by, say, the U.S. or Europe. And what we're doing with the IPCC is we're developing scientific understanding consensus throughout all the nations of the world, and we're developing a diversity of national expertise, so every country has their experts they can turn to get the word on where we stand on climate change and why it matters to them and not just to the rich countries or not just to the other poor countries, all right? And they've already hashed out through an exhausting process of report and review and report and review you know, where the consensus is, where the uncertainty is large, where it's small, and they can inform their national leaders and policymakers of that. And another thing that's happening, as I've said already, we're obviously not solving the problem through reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So increasingly, the IPCC is being asked by the governments to inform what are the impacts, not just so we can mitigate and keep them from occurring, but so the nations of the world can adapt to these impacts and to reduce the costs, economic and otherwise, in their own countries and communities. And what the IPCC is doing is also developing this local capacity to do this response at the national to local scale, both mitigation and adaptation. So the bottom line of my presentation, I hope everyone walks away thinking that it's working. It's a diplomatic success, though. It's a as much as it's a scientific success. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Okay. Thanks, Elizabeth. Yeah. Thank you very much, Peck. That was another terrific presentation. Thanks to all six speakers. I'd like to invite Dr. Bruce Alberts as the discussant for the panel, for the session, to come up and share his thoughts and reflections and some experiences, perhaps. And then we'll open it up and we'll do a Q&A discussion before we close today. Thanks.
I'll be brief because we need time for discussion. I've learned a lot today. I thought it was great. I'm a science envoy. It's a new idea, and I hope it's a lasting idea. It may disappear if we don't do something because, this is the way politics is. Obama suggested the idea in his June Cairo speech and appointed three envoys, Ahmed Zouail from Egypt, Elia Suhuni, originally from Algeria, and myself from Chicago. I took the thing, and we're all busy. It's all a volunteer thing. You're lucky if they pay you for your transportation. It takes a long time if you get reimbursed. But anyway, basically because I sense that this could be a great thing, as the other two envoys. And we wanted to, as the first envoys, we had this opportunity to experiment and explore and try to figure out what we might propose going forward to make a permanent program. My first country was, I only have two countries, and one of the things I would say that we learned is that you shouldn't only have two countries. Some of them were given so many countries they can't possibly do it. I was given Indonesia as my first country, and it's a great place to work. And I discovered a lot. I've been twice. I'm going again in July. I had a strong sense not to overpromise because I've seen time and time again, U.S. making formal agreements, science agreements with other countries, were a lot of hoopla, and then we never follow through and do anything, and we have a reputation for that around the world. So before I went to Indonesia, I made sure we had some money for something, because the idea was doesn't have a budget for the Science Envoy program, so you have to go to other agencies. And I wanted to focus entirely on capacity building, as everybody's described here, how important that is. It's often not as much fun as going in there and solving the problem quickly, but we've learned from long experience that only building local capacity is going to make any long-term difference. You know, this Pedro's example, just sending them corn, it can disrupt their ability to actually develop their own capacity. So I think USAID should be all about capacity building. Everything should be about capacity building. I think we all agree that, all three envoys agree about that. And specifically to try to connect younger scientists and engineers from the United States to their future leaders, because that's the real investment for the future. The Academy of Sciences, when I was there for 12 years, we started something called Frontiers of Science with 40, the first one was 40-year-old, roughly, future leaders of science in the United States with 40 Chinese. That means every year has been incredibly successful. Of course, you rotate out of it very quickly. You're no longer young. But we have now that same program with India, Japan, Germany, and so on. And so now we have a new Frontiers program with Indonesia, and I'm going in July to the first meeting in Jakarta. But basically, the idea is that six scientists from each side meet and organize a meeting for 3 days. They decide what they want to cover, and it's a lot of discussion. And basically, then the Americans will go off to universities, try to meet people, and through random collision, find effective collaborations if they can. We also have funds in Indonesia for university partnerships. That's a traditional USAID program, but we're trying to reinvent the mechanism so that we really find the best partners. I'm Walter North, who was in one of those pictures, actually is very much interested in trying an experiment where we have a competition in Indonesia for the universities, the site visits, choose the universities there and the programs first, and then have a competition for the partners on the other side. The traditional way is, of course, you have to know somebody already to write the big grant, and then if you're successful, you get a lot of money. So I would like a little bit of money for the university in Indonesia to come and find partners in the United States and basically try to optimize the pairings and set an example for merit-based distribution of resources in science. One of the primary things I learned in Indonesia was that the young people there want a merit-based system of science and education. And, you know, my first sort of encounter with that, what is that? Because we take it for granted, but there's basically no competitive funding right now in Indonesia, and I gather there are problems with universities as well. These are all long-term goals. I was really happy to hear so many echoes of what I believe is we're learning. In addition, our U.S. government is not well organized to do this kind of thing. Several of you mentioned the domestic-only policies, silos. I mean, our embassy didn't even know a lot about some of the projects that I randomly encountered as I was going around the country. And this whole issue of perverse incentives for non-governmental organizations that we heard about so eloquently in Haiti, sadly, you know, to do their own thing and really interfere with capacity building and actually getting the right thing to happen. That's another problem we're trying to counter. I'm trying to set an example. For example, in Indonesia, one of the things they want is, actually the president of Indonesia wants to be like everybody else, an innovation nation. But his kid experience when he was here for a year training as an army general, his kid experienced really quality science education in Kansas. And he spent a half hour when we met with him, the first half of our meeting, talking about he wanted inquiry-based active science learning in their schools, which they don't apparently have. And so we're starting that process. It's a long-term process. You know, it doesn't make any sense to fly in Americans to train their teachers, really. Australia has exactly the same kind of movement. They have really good people actually starting out of their Academy of Sciences. And so I'm trying to see if we could arrange a partnership with Australia to do this, so we're not flying Americans halfway around the world. But that kind of thing is something that we're going to try to codify. We've been asked, actually, Rajiv Shah suggested that we try to codify what we've learned because it will help him with his thrust at USAID. And so the first three envoys are overdue for our first draft. Unfortunately, I'm the least busy of them because Ahmed Zewail is now running for president of Egypt. Elias Zerhouni got a job suddenly to become the CEO of Sanofi, a big pharmaceutical company in Paris. So I'm the guy with lots of time. So you can see what's happening. They all sent me stuff, and I'm supposed to be working with it. Anyway, we would like to make a toolkit of best practices, learn from all these things. The experiences in Guatemala, for example, I'm actually on the Moore Foundation board. We need to learn from you. We bought lots of land that's not being protected. And I think we now recognize that we need to bring science into the process. And so, you know, make a science out of international development would be the long-term goal. Harness for all every major country, China, India, have a science envoy. We could serve for, you know, 3 years and then be out of it. But our role is really to connect the best people in both countries to each other. Our embassy in China, for example, I go there every year. I don't think there's any idea, you know, of who the good scientists in the United States to bring to China, or who the best people are in China to interact with. It's just not on the radar screen. But that is the future of China and U.S. relationship is this big scientific technology thing. So, at any rate, I'll stop there. I just want to thank everybody for helping me understand better my job. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bruce. We have 10 minutes left, and what I would like to do is give those in the audience the opportunity to ask questions or comment. Rather than bringing all six speakers and the discussant up here, what I'd prefer you to do is come to the microphone if you have a question or comment, and direct it at someone, and then we'll get this microphone to them. So if we could start the process, you can make a comment, you can offer a question. Please feel free. I'm sorry that we're having to compress this, but I'm seeing a red light back there that says at 4:30 I've got to vacate this room, or we've got to vacate the room. So once again, if you have comments or if you'd like to comment or ask a question to our discussant, Dr. Alberts, please feel free with that. Please come. And if you'd identify yourself.
Yes, my name is Cheryl Palm from Columbia University. I was pleased to hear that USAID has gone from 2 AAAS fellows now to 30 or so. My question is it all Americans, or are you having programs with other countries?
Yeah, and as you answer, if you wouldn't mind coming to the front, that would be great. Or just, there you go.
So I actually don't know the rules of the AAAS Fellowship Program, but yeah, I was going to say, I think that program is all Americans, but last night I was sharing with my colleagues on the panel that USAID has just signed an MOU with the National Science Foundation so that as NSF funds American researchers to do research overseas, we can pair with that so that we can fund the developing country science component of that. And that's a brand new MOU. I think we just signed it a week or two ago.
Thank you, Julie. Pierre. Yes, Gary, if you'd come forward. In the meantime, let me say that when we end here today, if those of you in the audience have ideas or comments, if you would like to contact me, and my email address is in the guide, and also the co-chair for these sessions, Esther Stein from National Academy and Melody Brown-Berkins from the University of Vermont. The U.S. National Committee for the IUGS has 3 priorities for our committee's activities. Priority number 1 is science diplomacy. Priority 2 is mineral resource issues. Priority 3 is science education. So the U.S. National Committee for IUGS plans to continue active involvement in the science diplomacy area, particularly once again identifying lessons learned, best practices, and what are the challenges, what are the impediments perhaps. So once again, when we leave here at 4:30, you still have a way to make your voice heard on the issue of science diplomacy. Gary?
I have a question for Eric Kelly. I'm Gary Mayberry. I'm with USAID and the U.S. Geological Survey. And I work as the geoscience advisor for the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. So I face some of the issues that you discussed about trying to communicate with decision makers about the importance of science. And you discussed looking at some of the seismic hazard issues in Haiti. And in my experience, I found that the issue is often looking more at seismic risk, or just in the geologic sciences in general, looking at risk. And I'm wondering if there's been if you've seen any movement in Haiti to address risk and to do that in a multidisciplinary fashion, as I believe Dr. Sanchez spoke about. I don't see a lot of scientists talking to more of the social scientists or partnering with the non-governmental organizations that might be able to help to disseminate information to at-risk communities in a culturally appropriate way that as scientists we don't normally have the capability to do. So I'm wondering if you're seeing any of that done in Haiti.
It's barely starting, but it is starting. I think one of the examples that show that it's happening is that the Interim Commission for the Reconstruction of Haiti, which is a very important body right now in Haiti because it approves projects, large-scale projects. They have a big thing on their agenda, which is relocating people who are still, tens of thousands of people still living in tents. And one of the aspects of their projects is to take into account risk and take into account vulnerability, not rebuilding vulnerability at all levels, socially and social vulnerability, economic vulnerability, and of course the structural vulnerability of buildings as well, There is actually a workshop with all stakeholders, and it will include NGOs and major NGOs, UN, some UN agencies, and of course the government of Haiti. It's happening very slowly. I guess I'll take this opportunity to make a comment, which is that the earthquake in Haiti has been forgotten very quickly, even though it was an earthquake that killed 200,000 people and caused 100% loss in GDP. A lot of people don't realize that it will happen again, and that it's a challenge for us to, and it's important, therefore, to talk about hazard as well for that reason. And we should, of course, think about risk, too. There are major urban development projects, one big one in Haiti right now in downtown Port-au-Prince, that is not including earthquake risk reduction in their as a prerequisite. And we're trying to change that. So it's a tough problem, but some progress is made.
Thank you, Eric. Any other questions or comments? One of the things that struck me and that was a new experience for me to hear is the importance of the ability of scientists to communicate their science. I think it came through very clearly in all six of the presentations. And one particular aspect that Eric's and Peck's highlighted for me is this issue of communicating uncertainty. And the difficulty or the challenge that decision makers, typically elected officials or self-appointed leaders, have in understanding or dealing with this concept of uncertainty or probability of events. And so I think that's something, that's one of the key lessons that I'm taking away from this session is the importance of having good people who are practiced at communicating science. And I'm including not just the scientists here, but we've got Randy Shostak here from American Geophysical Union. I think there's some other media folks here. But the importance of getting the word out about this type of session in those types of vehicles that will be more widely read than just by the science community. So I'm making a pitch here, Randy, that we highlight this. And secondly, the fact that Dr. Alberts has highlighted the fact that I'm guessing Secretary Clinton and President Obama, they want to see a report pretty soon from what value have these science envoys demonstrated in their first year of practice or their first year of work. And so I think we all have to be quite proactive in getting the message out about the importance that science can play in helping decision makers, whether it's here in the United States at the county or state level or whether it's at the international level. And there's I would say, a scientific responsibility, almost an ethical responsibility, to make sure that we communicate what it is we know about, that we have to communicate. I see another hand up there if you'd like to make a comment.
Very short. Another aspect besides communication is certainly also work together. I am the scientific counselor at the French embassy here, and I work right now with APLU on Africa, African cooperation between the American University and African University, and last week we discovered with APLU how little we knew what the other ones were doing, okay? And it's so important that we converge with the local people first and all together with them, that I think it's one of the things which it's silly how much we ignore each of what we are doing each other. Okay, so I'm happy being here, although I used to work more with Africa, with Vietnam. Being here, I think I can still have an action on these countries working with you. Okay, thank you.
Very good. Thank you for that comment. We have a comment from any of the speakers. First to John.
I wanted just to reply to your comment. A couple of years ago, our the head of the Indonesian CBGHM, decided that it would be really good to bring the donor countries together around the table. And we had a meeting, which we literally had, you know, cards, and these are all just people in just in the world of volcanology from each nation. And we agreed we would do something, you know, much more grand, and we took a grand term. We called it the Bandung Accord, and it was an agreement among the partners that we would look at priorities with our, and it was done by our counterpart. They brought us together, and they said, let's look together at priorities across the country for volcano monitoring. And right now, this Merapi response, I didn't say this, but it was an international response. The Japanese and the French were our partners with the Indonesians, and they brought us together. And in fact, it was the president of Indonesia who came out and said, after that big eruption, let's bring in the international teams and let's work together to solve the problem. So I think the ideal on this is it's kind of difficult when you're coming in and telling your counterpart to bring, you know, or talking to your other, you know, the French and the Japanese or the Belgians on the side, it's better to have them, you know, invite you to talk to one another. And if we can instill that ethic, that's just wonderful.
Thank you very much, John. Any of the other presenters, Julie or Peck or Eric, Pedro, anybody else have anything else they'd like to comment? Yeah, Julie?
Just putting my anthropology hat on for a second, I'm hearing a lot of people obviously talk about how important it is to identify the local stakeholders and to bring them in early into the conversation, and I completely agree with that. I just want to make the point that it's not very easy. And I think that a lot of people who don't work in developing country contexts, it's not like people walk around with labels on that say we have an equity in this issue. So just to give an example to illustrate sort of the complexity I'm talking about, I was working in Peru on the issue of forest governance in Peru. The U.S. and Peru signed a free trade agreement, and one of the requisites of the trade agreement was that Peru needed to reform governance of the forest sector. And they brought in a whole bunch of people from the U.S. government to help them do that. So I was the forestry representative for USAID working on this. And figuring out who you needed to talk to was an unbelievably complex thing, because let's face it, most of us work in the capitals of these countries, but the real stakeholders and the equities are out in the field. And in the case of a place like Peru or any of the other countries that we have talked about today, you know, you're days and days out. We have two in Peru, for example, we have two different competing associations that claim to represent indigenous people in the Amazon. Which one do you work with? So I'm not disagreeing at all with the point. I just want to make the point that it is, if we don't always do it as well as we should, it is because it is very difficult to identify who has equities, and a lot of the donors and the government officials who work on these issues are sitting comfortably in the capital when the people who really need to be talked to are very far away and you have to make an effort to reach out to them.
Yeah, very good point, Julie. Thank you very much. Well, in order to honor your schedules, it's already after 4:30. I want to thank, on behalf of my co-organizers, Esther Stein and Melody, we want to thank you, the participants, the presenters, for joining us today. And Dr. Alberts, thank you for being our discussant. And we look forward to continuing this dialogue on science diplomacy. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. This concludes this session. For information regarding other sessions in this series, please call AVIN at 1-800-810-TAPE.